This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Judith Lucy, and I'm overwhelmed and living. I just don't like how I'm living. But am I really capable of change? And can that change help not just me, but the planet? Last episode, we looked at the idea that the pandemic made a lot of us look at our lives and go, wow, this sucks. But annoyingly, change is quite hard. I'm pretty determined, though, and I absolutely know that I want to at least try to do what I can about climate change. So this time, we're looking at what we can do as individuals in an episode called Absolutely Everything is My Fault. During lockdown, I let my body hair grow. From the neck down, it was a jungle. I mean, really, it was like the Amazon rainforest. So I'm pretty sure I was storing carbon. I also haven't had kids and I've never driven. So that's me done, right? I'm just one person after all. I kind of wish I did feel like that. But the truth is that I can't believe how long it took for me to really understand what a pickle we're all in. I'd always thought that I was reasonably environmentally conscious. I recycled, I was catching more public transport, and every time I flew, which was a lot, I paid those 12 cents or whatever it is, maybe it's 3 marbles, to offset carbon. I mean, I'm a nice person. I care about other stuff. Hasn't Leonardo DiCaprio got the whole climate thing covered? Apparently not. Certainly if Don't Look Up is anything to go by. Once I had my snorkeling with a whale moment, I realised that I had to do so much more. And now I'm frankly completely riddled with guilt about everything. I remember listening to a podcast about sustainability, and when they started talking about toothbrushes as I was brushing my teeth, I just felt like Donald Trump. Sorry, I meant to say the devil. My brush was plastic! Why didn't I just pick up an axe and start gutting ducklings? Of course, then I started buying bamboo toothbrushes. But listen to this from Choice magazine. If they are disposed of in landfill, they will degrade and create methane. What? You're meant to dispose of them in your home compost. I don't even have a home compost. But there's more. Of course, the bristles are still nylon, so you're actually meant to snap the heads off or pull them out with pliers. Why didn't somebody tell me? Okay, the word overwhelmed doesn't even cover how I was feeling when it came to personal responsibility about all of this. But it was time to get a grip, just not on a plastic toothbrush. It was time to get some help. So I asked a whole bunch of people to come over to my flat and give me some advice about how to live more sustainably. I started off with Brett Hedger, the Greenhouse Programs Officer at City of Port Phillip.
Just think about what are you prepared to do? You think this is an emergency? What are you prepared to do and why haven't you done it already? Do you really need me to tell you what those things are that you need to do?
That's a video that you can find on YouTube called Zero Impact Man, where Brett suggests 52 challenges that you can implement to live more sustainably. I find Brett inspiring, but he also makes me feel so guilty that I want to kill myself, which could be counterproductive. But then again, Brett wants a lot less people on the planet, so actually, he'd probably say that I could use his oven. Of course he wouldn't. Brett hasn't used gas for years. Brett suggests trying a new climate emergency-related challenge per week, but not just for a year. Forever. Most of Brett's suggestions I really want to do, like changing banks and stop using supermarkets. But then he also says things like, stop flying. I mean, am I going to start walking to comedy venues in other states? And compost your sewage. Sorry, that was me dry retching. When I asked him to describe how he lives, he replied, "It's like indoor camping." Understandably, I was a little self-conscious about Brett evaluating my home. Suddenly, I felt like I was living in a giant lump of coal with a stuffed turtle with a plastic straw coming out of its nose mounted on my wall. Jesus, I was so nervous, you'd think I'd ask Brett to come over and screw me. Which, in a sense, he did. But he also wound up giving me advice that would not only benefit the earth, but my wallet. I am braced here. I let you look at my electricity and water bill. So you're here, you're in my two-bedroom flat in Balaclava. I think without even batting an eyelid, Brett, you can probably tell me a lot of things that I could be doing better. Let it rip.
The first thing that jumped out to me is who you buy your electricity and gas from.
I know.
AGL is the biggest polluter in Australia. If you were time poor, you didn't have too much time to think about this, I think the best thing to do is change companies, change to a green company. And my recommendation there is to use the Greenpeace electricity guide.
Mm-hmm.
If we just turn the page, that's your last 2 years of electricity consumption. What I'm showing Judith here is a chart of interval data. And what we can see is the high usage is in winter, mm-hmm. which points to heating,
yep.
which is that split system up on the wall.
Yep.
When you were away, even though you weren't here, you were still using 2.2 kilowatt hours a day.
How does that happen?
Well, it's just standby power. It's just things you leave on. But that equates to 28% of your power consumption.
So Jesus wept.
Even if you weren't here, you'd still use 28% of your power.
Oh, my God, Brett.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we look at your...
I knew this would be embarrassing.
We look at your refrigerator. Your fridge is old and inefficient.
Yeah.
It's using 20% of your power.
Wow.
Yeah. Turn everything off at the PowerPoint. Most people leave things like modems and other bits and gadgets on all day, every day.
That's just what I do. Stop it.
Shut them down. I reckon you could easily save 50%.
So for starters, new fridge and just turn everything off. What I also love about your 52 ideas is that you've also got stuff in there like grow up, slow down, and put basically love ahead of greed.
Absolutely. Greed is the cause of all of this. How did we let Bezos, Gates, and what's the other guy, Musk, control the world? How did that happen?
But do I really need to be able to lift my own body weight, Brett?
Yes.
Why?
Because we're going to be living in bunkers.
I think we're going to leave it at that, Brett. Sorry, just doing chin-ups. If you take nothing else from this series, remember that we're all going to be living in bunkers. Okay, now it was time to talk to Lachlan Hennessy from the Yarra Energy Foundation. I'd spoken to Lachlan before, and he told me about great energy choices, including better heating and cooling options, and how I might be able to explore solar power and switching to 100% renewable electricity. He talked to me both as a renter and as a filthy cigar-smoking landlord. Yep, I'm both. Guess what I did with all that information? That's right, nothing. Did I really need to hear it again? Probably not. But how many opportunities do I get to have a man under 35 in my flat who I'm not related to?
I'm a renter as well, so I can definitely relate to the situation you find yourself in. And I always start with the shifts in approach and perspective, and that sort of feeds into everything else. I'm wearing merino thermals at the moment. Just all of the basics I think are important to...
And you're wearing them well.
I'm also wearing other clothes on top of that.
Yeah, yeah. You're right to point that out. People may have presumed you were just sitting here in thermal underwear.
Have a blanket ready on hand. Program your heater so that it turns on half an hour before you need to get up. Have the timer set so that you don't have to turn it off necessarily yourself. My bedroom has a big north-facing window with my blinds open. The sun shines through the window, it blazes in, and it feels like I have a heater on.
Mm.
I'm hesitant to use figures, but I will anyway. But I've read that 75% of light that enters your home through a window is converted into heat.
I remember having a conversation with you about solar heating too.
Yeah. incredibly attractive aspect to an apartment. What you would need to do is engage the owner's corporation, and you'd be seeking a quorum of support for a project like this. But the first step is just starting the conversation with your neighbours, because financially speaking, it makes sense, especially with the energy crisis at the moment. There's no world in which it doesn't make sense for the most part.
But how we initially met was, in fact, I was involved in a night called Getting Off the Gas. So that is certainly something landlords can look at, isn't it?
You can retrofit an apartment so that, you know, you're using an induction cooktop instead of a gas cooktop. A lot of apartments have their own water heater. A heat pump hot water system is an electric alternative to gas or the traditional electric water heaters. And they're about 3 to 5 times more efficient than the traditional electric ones. And the last thing would be heating. But there's a lot of either gas hydronic heating or ducted heating in Melbourne. And reverse cycle air conditioners or split systems, they're the most efficient form of heating and the most efficient form of cooling.
I also have a balcony, which is like a kind of hellscape. The only things I appear to be growing are a mop and, thanks to my nephew, an overflowing ashtray. I want to grow stuff I can eat and encourage things like native bees. And maybe one day I can compost and even have a worm farm. I never used to see the point of gardening. It wasn't earning me money or getting me trashed. Actually, that's not true. In the 90s, my flatmate and I had 2 marijuana plants, but they were stolen. It really was a mistake reporting that to the police. I thought I'd enlist the help of the woman who got me excited about putting my hands in the dirt a few years back. Eco-psychologist, garden coordinator and education officer at the Port Phillip Eco Centre, Deb Punton. And yes, she was in the last episode. She's virtually my co-host.
Look up your council website, and they usually have a plant list of Indigenous plants for your area. See if you can find out which ones are high biodiversity value, the ones that are going to bring in several different types of insects into your garden. Simple things that, such as the leafy greens, they're quite easy to grow. They don't often get problems. You could even put in Warrigal greens, which are very similar to the bower spinach, which is Indigenous to this area, and that's also edible for you. It's a perennial, so it's not like your English spinach, which is an annual. The other great thing about Indigenous plants, they're used to being on this land. They're used to the conditions of this land, so they're always a good choice. But it's nice to have a few of those leafy greens you enjoy.
And what's the best place to source plants or seeds from?
Most areas have a local Indigenous nursery, and councils also will be able to provide that information. Start with some little plants and from a local nursery and just pop them in. But I think for lettuce, we can just start them from seed, because I think you'd enjoy sprinkling those seeds yourself, nurturing them, and then being able to pick their leaves and eat them. And the taste is so much better.
I really did want to grow stuff. I'd looked after some plants for a friend during lockdown and only killed one. I even spoke to them daily. I'd say, "Good morning, and how about a root?" I still got it. I also wanted to cook more, so I felt less like I was in a polyamorous relationship with my Uber Eats delivery guys. Cooking's not my strong suit. A housemate once caught me looking up how to boil an egg. I asked Simon Tui for help, MasterChef Grand Finalist and champion of plant-based eating and sustainability. If there was a man who could teach someone with the skills of an inebriated gibbon how to cook a delicious vegetarian dish with very little waste, it was him. Well, what are we cooking today,
so,
Simon?
So I'm cooking you dinner, and also here's some things we grew in our farm. That's a lie. That's actually, we got these from the local farm, IGA. Old Italian dish. We're going to cook broccoli until it's mush.
Fantastic.
But in a good way.
Great.
There's a skill to it, right?
Excellent.
And it's all going to be done in about 7 minutes. So,
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's the thing. So all we're doing is creating nutrition through cooking great quality produce, our wonderful filler, which is our pasta of any description you really like.
Fantastic.
And we all like pasta.
Yeah.
But what happens is the best thing about this is we cook the broccoli and the pasta together in the water. Yeah, and then we toss it together with oil, lemon juice, and make it like a little sauce out of that. And then it is just heavenly. It's
that
one of my favourite dishes.
Just for anyone listening. listening, what are some sort of really basic sort of tips on sustainability when you're cooking? Is it really just as simple as stop throwing everything out, just use more shit?
It's a habit that we've been given from our parents or from what we've watched on TV and all that sort of stuff, like peeling potatoes. Like, I just don't know whether you do that, but it's not a thing anymore. Like, stop doing it. Or peeling carrots. Like, stop peeling your bloody carrots. All the flavours on the outside. The broccoli leaves are so delicious. Making things like collard greens from broccoli leaves, awesome. Just put them in some stock with some salt and some pepper and cook them for half an hour until they're really soft. Put them on rice. Bam, so delish. So what we'll do is we'll boil this pasta with the broccoli for 8 minutes until it's al dente. Then we're going to put it in the pan with what is going to be now. So we've got the garlic and the spring onions on a very low heat. And then all we're doing is infusing that oil because we don't want it to go brown. The broccoli will be super, super tender. But what the broccoli is going to do, it's going to actually season everything and make a sauce because it goes soft and mushy and it binds everything together and emulsifies the oil with the water of the pasta liquid with the pasta and it makes it wicked. The world of the Irish sort of overcooked vegetables. I thought bringing it a full circle.
Yes.
Where we're still having overcooked mush vegetables, but in a completely
but
different
it's
way.
Delicious. For the people out there who are still very much, I don't know, meat focused, is it just like, well, start cutting out one a day or one a week? And
yeah. It's the idea of not forcing someone to do it. They've got to want to change. They're going to want to sort of maybe take that step, and so they don't know how. So the great way is to take that, just do one meal. You know, don't have bacon and eggs, just have eggs.
Yeah.
Or don't have bacon and eggs, have a tofu scramble. Or have tomato on toast, or have Vegemite.
Thanks, Simon. And you can find that recipe somewhere. My nephew actually ate most of it. He's vegetarian and will eat anything that doesn't have meat in it, possibly even glue. I was getting quite the to-do list. But I felt so much better because all the tips and advice seemed really doable. When it comes to personal responsibility and climate change, though, there's one dilemma I won't have to face. Should I have children? I'm menopausal, remember? So the only thing that's ever going to come out of my vagina again is the, regrettably, plastic dispenser that I use to deliver my estrogen pessary. But this is a huge, complicated choice for so many women, and I've seen friends grapple with it. Journalist Gina Rushton gave herself 9 months to write a book about her own journey with the motherhood question called The Most Important Job in the World. She explores it from every angle, and unsurprisingly, there's a whole chapter devoted to climate change. I wanted to know how she and other younger people were navigating this minefield. I know. I care about the young people. Who knew?
You know, I did 40 interviews for the book, and in basically all of them, climate change came up, even for the chapters that weren't about climate change. And it actually really surprised me how much it was on basically everyone's mind.
And when did this all change for you?
So, when I found myself in emergency surgery, basically I found myself in debilitating pain, ended up in an ambulance, ended up in an emergency ward and told after an ultrasound that I was bleeding internally and that one of my ovaries had quote-unquote died, which even as a reproductive rights journalist, I didn't know that your ovary could die. I think it probably made me realise that I wasn't as settled on the question as I thought I was. In the end, the ovary is alive, but they found endometriosis, which of course explained a lot for me, but also affects fertility. So it's kind of made me feel like I need to answer the question a bit faster than I probably did before.
For a long time, women were seen as selfish for not having kids.
Mm-hmm.
But now, thanks to the climate emergency, quite the opposite view is held by some people. Mm. What do you think of that attitude?
I think anything to do with motherhood is just like drenched in guilt.
I love the way that in every story, women are losing.
Totally,
I love the way that
yeah.
it always comes back to women feeling lousy.
Yeah, and morally kind of corrupt.
Yeah.
I do think this is shifting, but I remember just even in those earlier conversations in my early 20s, like the narrative was, how dare we consider having a child and adding another carbon footprint. And, you know, what's the point of having keep cups if we're going to procreate? And this really individualized notion of guilt and responsibility when it came to climate change. And I actually think that that is shifting a lot. I think that guilt has really evolved into an anger that recognises that it's actually kind of wild to think about abridging our desires for the size of our families before we think about, you know, transforming energy systems, or that that guilt should first take place in family planning rather than in boardrooms, in government.
I don't know a mother who doesn't feel bad. And now, of course, when you put climate change into the mix, if you decide to have a child, well, are you parenting as sustainably as you possibly can?
It's unending. Like, I interviewed Veronica Milson, who basically did this podcast where she tried to have a zero waste baby. And it was just a nightmare. Like, you know, doing the cloth nappies and the whole thing, and then basically learned that the amount of washing she was doing for the cloth nappies, like, it on balance didn't end up being such a radical decision, I guess. And I just think that if those are the individual choices parents are trying to make, it's tough.
You talk to a lot of scientists who have decided to have children. Mm. How do you think they were dealing with the guilt?
It was really interesting interviewing climate scientists with kids, because I think I'm definitely guilty of this. And I think a lot of people are, when it comes to climate anxiety, this kind of ambient dread that we all feel. It's very easy to sort of retreat into the horror and feel kind of paralysed by it. And I think that it was amazing watching these people who every day were dealing with grim data, like people who were watching entire species die out, who were marking sea levels, who were dealing with bushfire stuff, and had still chosen to have kids. And it was really amazing interviewing people who had done something basically with their guilt. And I think what I mentioned before is turned it into anger and action.
If we've got this attitude that, oh, well, it's all too late anyway, and we're just walking towards the apocalypse, that is like giving up.
It is like giving up, and it's a privilege. It's often the people who will be least affected by climate change who sook in that way, I guess. but it's hard. I mean, there's a writer in the book who I quote, who talks about doomer dudes and that kind of, oh, well, like, world is ending kind of attitude. And it's just, it's a luxury, really.
Gina, you write about, and God, it's so moving and not very cheery, but can you talk a little bit about the women giving birth during the bushfires and how smoke inhalation affected their pregnancies?
Yeah, so when that bushfire season was happening, I was still working as a reproductive rights journalist, really, and covering reproductive health care. And I remember at the time thinking, well, I guess, like, the whole news cycle is dominated by fires. Who should I interview? So I started calling obstetricians who were essentially dealing with pregnant women who were really anxious about what the smoke was doing to their pregnancy, and also delivering babies into, particularly in Canberra, like, wards that were actually filled with bushfire smoke. Like, there just wasn't a way to keep it out. And one of the GPs I interviewed was talking about the placentas, which are normally kind of pink and fleshy and come away quite easily, being grey and looking like the placenta of a sort of pack-a-day smoker, which is, like, really horrific to think about.
How did you feel about your decision, or whatever that decision might wind up being, at the end of the book?
I think that I really finished in a place that sort of made me feel a little more empowered to face some of those existential questions without retreating into the dread. I think it's good to be a bit honest about what's actually impacting the decision the most, because the climate question and how we handle that and live with that and feel hope and feel like we're doing something about that, that will happen whether or not you have kids. Like, that's going to be a question for all of us for a long time. So that's not going anywhere.
I'm still really glad that's a decision I don't have to make. Sometimes being a barren spinster really rocks. I absolutely believe that we all have to do as much as possible when it comes to the climate emergency. But some people are actually benefiting from the crippling guilt we feel as individuals because it lets them, or rather their corporations, off the hook. I kind of knew that. But when I heard Walkley Award-winning writer, editor and broadcaster Jeff Sparrow talk about his new book, Crimes Against Nature, it really crystallised things for me. I wanted to alleviate some of my guilt, so I asked Jeff what the hell we can do about it all. Jeff, I loved your book because, frankly, it's the only thing I've read about the climate emergency that hasn't made me think that people are just inherently shit. And I want you to talk about this because I think the majority of us do not realise that ordinary people have actually questioned everything from cars to single-use plastic bags. I mean, why don't most of us know that? And was that a big motivator in terms of writing the book?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, isn't it? And definitely was a motivator in terms of writing the book, because I think even people who consider themselves environmentalists or progressives tend to internalize this sense that all of us are responsible for the environmental crisis. And the problem is that human beings are innately, almost genetically, lazy and selfish and unable to think about the collective good. And because of that, we are just greedily using up all of the planetary resources. And that's why we're in the mess that we're in now. And of course, as soon as you start to look at the question historically, you discover that that's not the case, that on almost every environmental issue, you can see a fairly clear conflict between a small number of people who have got an immediate and material interest in promoting environmental practices and an almost instant reaction from the rest of the population who say, hang on, we don't want this. You know, you mentioned plastic bags. I mean, most people don't know that when the plastics industry tried to introduce plastic bags to supermarkets, there was a revulsion from consumers who until then were accustomed to bringing in recyclable bags and filling them up and taking them home. And people had to be actively taught that single-use plastic bags were a good thing. And I think so this narrative that we're all to blame is promulgated because the people who have an interest in the environmental crisis, well, blaming everyone is really useful to them. Because if we internalize this idea that there's something about human nature that makes it impossible for us to live in a sustainable way, well, as soon as we say that, then we essentially give up on any kind of fight to change things. I mean, if it's part of human nature, then by definition, there's nothing we can do about it. So I think it's really, really important to make an argument that it's not the case. It's not, the problem isn't something innate in human beings. The problem is something to do with a particular way that we live in this society.
Thanks to your book, I now know that time and again, big business has managed to put the blame and responsibility for their actions on individuals. Who came up with the idea of the old carbon footprint?
The notion of the carbon footprint has been internalized, even by people who think of themselves as environmentalists. You know, it was a concept that was promoted by a PR company that was hired by BP, the fossil fuel company. And the reason for it, of course, is as soon as you start thinking about carbon footprints, it encourages ordinary people to compare their own carbon footprint with BP's. BP has a carbon footprint, you have a carbon footprint. So rather than worrying about, you know, politically trying to organise against the fossil fuel companies, maybe what you should really be worrying about is reducing your own carbon footprint. And we really do need to get angrier about these issues, and we really do need to start pointing the finger.
It seems to me that capitalism has screwed the planet. Why aren't more people saying that?
Look, I obviously agree, and it's one of the central arguments of the book. I do think that we live in a time where political and even more so economic alternatives have been systematically destroyed, and so capitalism seems like the horizon for most people. It's almost impossible for a lot of people to imagine any kind of alternative. And that's one reason why I think it's important to think historically about climate change and to realize capitalism has only been with us for a few hundred years. And prior to that, human beings lived in very different ways, and those different social systems interacted with the natural world in very, very different ways. So we haven't always lived like this, and there's no reason why we necessarily have to live like this in the future.
Jeff, I guess the big question is, how realistic is it to think we can get rid of capitalism, and what are we replacing it with?
Yeah, so I guess it depends what you mean by realism. I mean, I suppose I would flip that question around. How realistic is it to think that we can go on like this?
Mm.
The moment we're in is increasingly one of crisis, and I think we can say that the future is not going to be the same as the past. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the future will be better, but there's no reason to think that it's not possible to make it better. You know, we have the technology that would enable us to immediately start repairing the worst damage that we've done everywhere. And we have scientific knowledge that, in, you know, is little short of wondrous, that there's no reason why we can't devote all the best minds of humanity to fixing the planet rather than destroying it. The thing that stops us is the economic logic that says the only thing that can happen are things that create profit. So we're in a time where, you know, anything could happen, and the catastrophes that are coming down the barrel towards us are going to fundamentally reshape, you know, the political possibilities in the way that the bushfires and the floods and then COVID have completely changed the political possibilities. I mean, COVID is a really good example, actually. Remember, immediately after, you know, the pandemic started to come to Australia, all of a sudden, all of these things that had been previously completely off the political agenda were suddenly being discussed by politicians of all stripes. And we had a Conservative Prime Minister introduce, you know, a program to save the jobs of people who weren't going to be able to work. Now, and that wasn't a market system. That was an anti-market system. Mm. Okay, if it's possible to do that in the face of COVID, why can't we do it in the face of climate? So I think we are in a situation where it's incredibly fluid, and that can be scary, right? Because we don't know what the next horrific thing that's going to happen is. But at the same time, it does open up possibilities.
You do recommend 12 things people can do at the end of the book if you'd like to talk about any of those, so people listening just don't turn this off and kill themselves.
Yeah, don't do that. Well, like I say, the first and most important thing is to find other people, to act collectively, because it's not simply that collectively we're more likely to make a change. It's immediately motivating to find other people who feel the same way that you do and, you know, that you can work alongside them. So, you know, the form that might take varies depending on your situation, whether that's, you know, joining a trade union at work, whether that's a community group, whether that's an environmental organisation. People's situations are different. Talk to your friends, talk to your family, talk to your workmates, you know, persuade them to join the cause and to join the organisations that you're involved with. I think that's the kind of thing that can make a difference. Not only can make a difference, can make you feel better about the crisis. Like, we are living in scary times, but the times become a little bit less scary if we're facing them alongside other people.
I still feel guilty, but I grew up Catholic, so I'll always feel guilty. But I was also starting to feel energized, which is lucky because, boy, when I stop being busy making this podcast, I am going to be flat out budgeting, eating broccoli stalks, buying woolen underwear, and assassinating space billionaires. But as Jeff Sparrow pointed out, we need to come together to make real change happen. And in the past, I'd found that the best first step was seeing what was out there in my local area. So that's what we're going to be doing next time in a little episode called Maybe I Don't Hate Everyone? I'm Judith Lucy, and I'm overwhelmed and living! Judith Lucy, Overwhelmed and Living was written and performed by me, Judith Lucy. Producer Beth Atkinson-Quinton with assistance from Lisa DeVisi. Sound engineer David LeMay. Theme music Gareth Skinner. And executive producer Tom Wright.
Hey there, it's Yumi Steins here, host of the smash hit ABC podcast, Ladies, We Need to Talk. Ladies is all about busting taboos around sex, health and relationships. We dig into the stuff that's actually hard to talk about. This season, we're looking at why so many of us are feeling utterly burnt out and how we can help ourselves repair when we're already running on empty.
On the Monday when I was meant to return to work, I just couldn't get myself out of bed. I just couldn't do it.
We're making a big stink about why women are so ashamed of farting.
There's so much about women's bodies that are policed, and it's sort of an extension of that. Oh no, you can't fart because then you wouldn't be womanly. And it's like, what does womanly mean then? Does it not mean being a human?
And we're tackling an issue that no one wants to talk about, what it's like to face your own death.
I do allow myself to be sad, but I don't let it overcome me. You know, I've got five girls who need me, and they are the ones who, you know, make me get out of bed, and we just try to keep it as normal as possible.
I'd love you to join me on Ladies, We Need to Talk. Head to the ABC Listen app.